You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming out today. I think this will be one of the most exciting programs we've had in our energy program. I'm Charlie Ebinger, the director of the Energy Security Initiative. We've got probably some of the heaviest hitters in the whole Russian-European energy field, and we're delighted to have everyone here today. I won't introduce people individually because you have their bios. I only would like to thank Ed Chow coming from CSIS to be a commentator and our own Cliff Gaddy. And I would just like to say it's a particular honor for me today to sponsor this event because there are very few people that professionally you can say, in the case of Jonathan Stern, that we have known each other literally for close to 40 years. And we first met each other when Jonathan was working on Soviet natural gas. So it's a delight to have both him and Jim Henderson here today to launch what, once you have time to peruse, I think you'll find is one of the most outstanding books on this whole issue, certainly that I have ever seen. So without further ado, let me introduce Jonathan, and he'll kick us off, and then we'll have presentation for Jim, and then we'll move for open commentary, but leaving a lot of time for questions from the audience. Jonathan?
Charlie, thank you very much. And thank you all for coming. We really appreciate the opportunity to launch our book here. I want to say, in terms of protocol, that of course, as far as the Oxford University Press is concerned, the first launch is in London, which is next Tuesday. So, in a sense, we're not really here, but this just happened to fit really well. So, this is actually the first time we presented the book in public in this way. We come from a very small institute, which is part of Oxford University. We are some of the few people in a European university still doing research on the deeply unfashionable subjects of oil and gas. And you can see the title of the book. I'm just showing you the structure because we're just going to give you pretty much of a snapshot of a few issues, not all of these issues, although we're happy to talk about anything in the Q&A. We're not, in this presentation, going to talk about the Ukraine crisis, but we'd be happy to talk about it in the Q&A as well. The thing that you should probably understand about the approach of the book is that this is the first book on Russian gas that we've published since the one that I wrote in 2005 on Gazprom. And the subtext of that book was, would the Russians be able to develop enough supply for all of the markets they could possibly service, they could possibly deliver to? And the subtext of this book is that that situation has completely changed. That's no longer the question. The question is, can they deliver gas to rapidly changing markets where the market conditions and particularly the pricing conditions mean they are facing much more competition than was ever the case in the past? And the idea is not to go through all the numbers in this table. It's just to give you an idea of the complexity of the situation they face. Gazprom, but not just Gazprom, the Russian government faces a very, very complex mixture of supply sources and markets, which have to be managed on an ongoing basis as those markets are changing very rapidly. So I'm still listening to people who are talking about Gazprom's declining production and attributing that to some problems that Gazprom may be having. Jim will address that a little later on. I'm still listening to people who keep saying things like, well, what are they doing in Europe? Is this due to political or commercial issues? These are the kind of complexities that we're going to be addressing. We've addressed in the book, and we're going to be addressing a little bit in this presentation. Let me just locate you in terms of the importance of gas in the macroeconomic picture. People, and particularly journalists, tend to talk about oil and gas in the Russian economy, not realizing that the two are completely not comparable. So this just shows you I hope you can see, maybe at the back it's a little difficult. The three charts are the share of value-added sector in GDP, where gas is at least significant, nearly 10%, the share in exports, where gas is about 12.5% compared with oil at 54%, and the share of budget revenues, where oil is 42% and gas is 6.3%. So the key thing to remember is that gas is very, very important in the Russian energy balance, but it's not really important in the financial, in the big financial picture of the Russian economy. And this is just another way of looking at it, where those top two light blue and dark blue bars are the money that the Russian budget earns from gas taxes as opposed to the big green bars, which are about the money it earns from oil. So those people who keep saying that, oh, you know, we must try and impact on the financial aspects of gas because this will punish the Russian economy, they haven't got the picture remotely right. Let me rush on and just show you the big picture of Gazprom's long-term take-or-pay contracts in Europe. Now, the reason this is really important is that Americans, some of you I can see who I recognize, will remember an era before the 1980s when there were long-term take-or-pay contracts in this country, but that hasn't been the case for a long time. Long-term take-or-pay contracts are still alive and well in Europe. These bars, the top grey line, this line is the 85% take-or-pay line. This is what we think is more like the current situation. So what you see here are the contractual commitments. For those of you who are not familiar with billion cubic metres a year, if you divide by 10, you get to billion cubic feet a day. So basically what we're saying in this chart is that until the mid-2020s, European buyers are obligated to buy at least 10 billion cubic feet a day, and actually probably closer to 15 billion cubic feet a day from Gazprom under international contracts with legally binding arbitration. So all of this discussion about, oh, how can Europe reduce its dependence on Russian gas? If Europe wants to break these contracts, conservatively, very conservatively, it would need to spend between 400 and 600 billion euros to buy out these contracts. So that isn't going to happen. So essentially, this is the picture you need to have in your mind when you think about Russian gas exports to Europe. But there is some difficult, and I'm not going to go into it, dependence arithmetic, which people try to do, saying this country is dependent on Russian gas for this percent of its gas supply. That really isn't very helpful, even on an individual country basis, let alone a European basis. The thing that you probably need to keep in mind is that traditionally, virtually all of Russia's gas supplies flowed through the Ukraine, hence the problems that we're having at the moment. But that is now diversifying, and it has been specifically diversified because of the lack of trust that the Russians have had in the whole of the post-Soviet era, not just in the last year, not just since January 2009 when the last big disruption happened, but for the whole of the post-Soviet era due to non-payment and what the Russians construe as theft of gas. This is obviously disputed, but this has been the problem, that the Russians have not been able to control the supplies that have been flowing through Ukraine. As a result of that lack of control, they have progressively built transit diversification pipelines, of which the first was Nord Stream, which you see here, and you see better here, where we have two pipelines now up and running. But despite the fact that we have probably around 5.5 billion cubic feet a day of deliverability through those pipelines, they have not and are not running at that rate. And that is principally due to some complex regulation in the EU, which means that there has been a constraint on the amount of the amount of pipeline capacity that Gazprom has been allowed to use. That might have been resolved, but due to the most recent Ukrainian events and the political response in Brussels, it has not yet been resolved. But that is a relatively simple problem compared with this problem, which is the new South Stream pipeline going from Anapa to making landfall in Bulgaria. Now, again, we'll talk a little bit more about this in detail if people are interested, but there are very, very severe regulatory problems with the new regulation in Europe, connected with the fact that the new regulation in Europe has not yet been written. So it's very difficult to comply with regulation that you don't know whether it's been written. But the intergovernmental agreements and Gazprom's model for how this is going to work conflicts with even the main principles of the new European regulation. And this is very important because the really big problems in January 2009, and if we have a crisis in the next few weeks and months, have all been and will be in southeastern Europe. In other words, this line would deliver to countries like Bulgaria, Romania, Serbia, and the other former Yugoslav republics, which experienced the really huge problems in January 2009. And that's why this is a very important pipeline for one aspect of European gas security, but as I'm sure you'll appreciate, it's considered a threat in relation to other aspects of European gas and energy security. So that was a brief snapshot of the European part of this book and some relations to what the events of the moment. What I'm going to do now is to pass on to Jim Henderson, who's going to talk about other aspects of the book.
Okay, thank you, Jonathan. So one of the obviously interesting questions, the biggest questions that we try and ask in the book is you know, what's going to happen to Gazprom? Because obviously Gazprom is by far the largest producer and reserve holder in Russia in terms of gas, is the largest exporter into Europe, into the former Soviet Union, and the largest seller of gas in the domestic market. And the reason for the matrix concept and for the title, How Markets Are Driving Change, is because what we'd observed since Jonathan wrote his book in 2005, and particularly post the economic crisis in 2008-09, is that, to put it bluntly, Gazprom's gas had become the least desirable option in all of its markets. And the big question was, how is Gazprom responding to this change in its outlook and the need to find customers for its gas? And I think the best way to explain how this turn of events came about and caused a shift in outlook from 2005 really to 2008 is a combination of factors. The first of which was the stagnation of demand in Europe for gas post the economic crisis, and also to an extent as European governments started to the shift towards renewables. The second was obviously the unconventional gas revolution in the US, which led to LNG being available, diverted to the European market, and to an extent cheap coal. The third was the rise in the oil price, which meant that Gazprom's oil-related gas prices in Europe suddenly became very expensive. All that was happening and was leading to, if you like, a reduction in the demand for Russian gas at a time when on the supply side, rather unfortunately for Gazprom, they had made a fundamental decision around 2006 that they were going to develop a huge new region, the Yamal region, in particular the Bovnenkovskoye field, in northern Siberia, because there had been a concern prior to the economic crisis that Russia might not have enough gas to supply what at the time was growing demand in all its markets, 2005-2006. And this combination of events, the stagnation of demand, the availability of alternative supply, the high price of Russian gas, and the massive development of a new source of gas supply, led to, if you like, a kind of perfect storm for Gazprom, which is somewhat reflected in this graph. And what we try and address in the book is how Gazprom eventually has started to address the issue of its gas being the least desirable option and is now starting to develop strategies to solve that problem. But this graph is a graph that was published in 2013, and I apologise, it's slightly out of focus, so I'll point you at the colours. The dark blue is Gazprom's historic fields, the big Soviet legacy fields that have been in decline for some time, and you can see going forward in very, very sharp decline. And this was why the question was raised about the development of the Yamal fields, and the Yamal fields are the light blue, the sort of third tier of blue. And so essentially in 2013, Gazprom's outlook, as you can see, for its west-facing fields, which are the blue fields, is essentially that its production is not going to rise at all, really, over the next 20 years, as it faces this new demand outlook. And this contrasts very, very sharply with the outlook it had only a year earlier in 2012, which is kind of reflected in the high case, as they now call it, blue line. And you can see that essentially, it downgraded its production forecast by the best part of 100 billion cubic metres per year. So that what had been a growth trajectory has now turned into a very flat trajectory. But nevertheless, as you can see, the light blue expands dramatically. So essentially what's happened is that Gazprom has committed to developing gas in a more expensive region of Russia, in a very remote region of Russia, and is now becoming increasingly dependent on higher cost gas, and has also got a lot of it, an excess of it, because it has committed to this development of fields that could produce perhaps as much as 250 or 300 billion cubic metres per annum. And, as I'll show later, it has been forced to cut back its production expectations. So essentially now what we have in Russia is a gas bubble, is a theoretical oversupply of gas. There is a lot of gas to be produced by Gazprom and by non-Gazprom producers, the independents, as they're called. And so essentially now we have a very competitive market developing both in Russia and, as I've also described, in the export market for Russian gas. The other thing to point out on this graph is that all the growth, you can see, is going to come from the east, which is another new theme that is developed in the book. And last week, of course, Gazprom finally signed its export agreement with CNPC, which we can discuss in greater detail later. So the themes here are essentially Gazprom in the West is now fighting a significant competition in all its Western markets, Europe, the FSU, and domestically, has a pretty much a flat production outlook and has a lot of gas to produce, but really not enough markets to sell it in. And all its growth is going to come in the East. How are we doing that? This just talks to the kind of the theme of Yamal, the shift from the core West Siberian areas, Yamburg, Medvezhye, Urengoy, Zapolyanoya, the traditional fields, up to the northwest, Bovanenkovskoye, the massive new pipeline system that's been put in from the Yamal Peninsula, and the potential development of Kruzhenstern and Kharasevay as supplements, which are now being pushed much further out. And you can also see in the right at the top the Yamal LNG project, the Novatek project, which I'll talk about in a little while as well. But essentially, this shift away from the core areas into the rather more expensive developments in a Russian context of the Yamal Peninsula. And this is essentially Gazprom is tied in now to this new source of higher cost gas. In contrast with the Gazprom story, the other key theme in the Russian gas supply story has been the emergence of non-Gazprom producers, independent producers as they're called in Russia, particularly Novatek, and now the emerging force of Rosneft in the gas sector, Russia's national oil company, which is moving much more into gas. And this graph just demonstrates the theoretical growth of production from the independent sector. And as you can see, essentially, it could more than double by 2020. In reality, I think what will happen, because of contracts that have already been signed with customers, particularly in Russia, is that domestic independent production will reach somewhere between 250 and 300 billion cubic metres by 2020. But nevertheless, we see this shift away from Gazprom and towards the non-Gazprom producers because they've been able to compete with Gazprom, who have been forced to sell at regulated prices, which have been rising very fast, and essentially they've been undercut domestically by the independent sector. So a fundamental shift which could see Gazprom's market share in Russia fall below 50% easily by 2020. And the further element of competition that has emerged within Russia is now in the export market, where Novatek and Rosneft in particular are now allowed for the first time ever to sell gas to customers outside Russia in the form of LNG, and are preparing to do just that. So essentially Gazprom's position kind of under threat from domestic peers as well as from international peers. And this graph and this slide basically just makes the point that I made right at the beginning, that essentially there is a lot of Russian gas looking for a market. What I've done here in the graph on your left is just to say, what was Gazprom saying it could produce, or what is it saying it can produce in 2012? And that Alexei Miller has outlined that the company has potential production capacity of 600 billion cubic metres a year, despite the fact that it only sold 490 billion cubic metres last year. So there's a big uplift there. And I show historic independent production in 2012 and 300 billion cubic metres of independent production in 2020. And you can see there's just a huge potential surplus. I mean, it's theoretical, obviously, but a lot of gas available, potentially 900 billion cubic metres of gas available for demand of less than 800 billion cubic metres on most people's forecasts. And within that position, in Russia, Gazprom is the high-cost producer, is essentially becoming the swing producer, if you like, of Russian gas, which, of course, puts it in a difficult position, but also potentially a position of some strength as well, as I'll just describe at the end, because although in Russian terms it's relatively high-cost gas, in global terms, actually, Gazprom's gas is relatively competitive, both in Western markets and in Asia. In terms of just moving to the sort of Asia and competition, this just shows you Russia's LNG plans and just highlights the fact that although Gazprom itself has, you know, it controls the existing LNG production from Sakhalin 2, in fact, Rosneft now has a competing project in the same island, the Sakhalin 1 project, which it plans to bring on stream with Exxon by 2019. And most relevantly and most immediately, Novatek has its Yamal LNG project, which is planning to sell gas both into Asia, but also, interestingly, into Europe. And so we're seeing the first elements of competition for Gazprom in its core European market, as well as in the new Asian market. And, you know, I think that competitive threat, as much as anything else, may have catalysed Gazprom into doing its deal with CNPC and getting it done this year, because significant pressure was building up on Gazprom, particularly from Rosneft, to get an Asian deal done, which was obviously vital not just for Gazprom but for the Russian kind of political and commercial economy as well. In terms of the Asian deal, we can talk more about the exact details, but obviously the foundation of Russia's eastern gas strategy will now be the infrastructure that is going to be built from the Irkutsk and Yakutia regions on the left via the 3,500-kilometre pipeline that will run to, Blagoveshchensk on the China border here, and then on to the Vladivostok LNG plant here. And there is existing infrastructure down from Sakhalin, the Sakhalin-Khabarovsk-Vladivostok pipeline here. And these two pipelines will become the foundation for the development of an eastern strategy that could see Russia producing and selling in domestic and export markets up to 100 billion cubic metres a year within a decade or so. And so this is a fundamental shift in Russia's export strategy. It is hugely politically important, obviously, in terms of foreign policy, but also in terms of the domestic development of eastern regions. And it now provides Gazprom with the ability to re-establish itself as the dominant force in the Russian gas sector. A quick word while we're talking about Asia, about Central Asia. You know, we talk in the book about the shift, if you like, in Russian strategy in Central Asia from being the dominant buyer of gas from Turkmenistan Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, now to, if you like, becoming perhaps taking a subordinate role to China, who now obviously takes the vast quantities, increasing quantities of gas from the Galkanish field in Turkmenistan, is also set potentially to import gas from Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. And so we've seen essentially Russia and Gazprom accept a loss of geopolitical leverage in the region as the commercial realities of these countries' diversification strategies has meant that they're sending much more of their gas east than they are now sending it north. And we'd expect that to continue. We don't see exports from Central Asia into Russia rebounding at all to their historic levels, really remaining in the range of 20 to 30 BCM per annum for the foreseeable future. So just to conclude, given our half hour is up, this graph at the end is intended to show that we're, although some of the issues we address in the book have clearly been problems for Gazprom and Russia as markets have changed and have driven a change in strategy, particularly at Gazprom, actually Russia is in an interesting competitive position relative to the world's two major importing regions, Europe and Asia. Clearly, the vast amount of Russia's gas infrastructure points west towards the European market. And, you know, we believe, despite the fact that Gazprom, in a domestic context, gas is quite high cost, in a European context, is actually very competitive. And just to put a number on that, you know, we calculate that the break-even price of Yamal LNG at the German border is around $7.50 to $8 an MMBTU, which is competitive with anything we can see that could arrive in Europe to compete with that. Towards Asia, obviously, the new pipeline that will be built, the new reserves that will be developed, will provide gas into China at around $10 to $11 per MMBTU at the Chinese border, which, again, will allow Russian gas to be very competitive with Central Asian imports and future LNG imports and current LNG imports into China. So although Russia has had to face significant competitive threats over the last 5 to 6 years, as the markets in which it has sold its gas have evolved, in fact, the country finds itself in a competitive position, in a geographically ideal position to supply the major markets. And going forward, you know, if Gazprom can continue to adapt its marketing strategy, could find itself in a strong position relative to competitors over the next decade. I'll stop there, and we can certainly be happy to take lots of questions.
Well, I think Jonathan and Jim have given us a lot of points for discussion, and I thank you very much for a commendable piece of work that you've done. If I may just use the power of the chair, because our principal commentators are going to be Ed Chow and Cliff Gaddy, if I may just raise one question that you kind of ended your presentation on, Jim, but I guess the question that would emerge in my mind is, if the Chinese deal indeed comes to fruition and the addition of Russian gas moving into far eastern power markets, do you have any views on what that means for competitive LNG sources? And I'm thinking particularly, does this make it even more difficult, say, for Canadian LNG to come into the market and Gulf Coast LNG from the United States? And are we kidding ourselves that with all the hoopla about LNG coming out of the United States, that it may really be somewhat subdued from the more optimistic forecasts?
I think the context is that, assuming the deal goes ahead, as you say, and Gazprom kind of efficiently develops the infrastructure that's required, we're talking about 38, 40 BCM of gas into northeast China, into a market that will need, is looking to be supplied with 400 billion cubic metres of gas plus by 2020 if they meet their current targets. So we're talking 10% of Chinese of supply into the Chinese market. So I think there's plenty of room for alternative sources of supply, and I think that the Chinese very clearly have developed a kind of a compass of supply. We have Western supply from Central Asia, we have Southern supply from the pipeline from Myanmar, we have supply on the eastern seaboard from LNG, and clearly, you know, regasification is being expanded dramatically on the eastern seaboard. And then, you know, the Russian deal provided the very logical northern access to that supply, and obviously there's indigenous potential increase in supply from both conventional and unconventional sources. So I think there's still plenty of room for other LNG. I think what it interestingly does do, though, is start again to set a benchmark price for potential imports into China, because clearly the Chinese have started to set a domestic benchmark down in the southeast of the country related to LPG and fuel oil. This deal looks like it's linked to oil and oil products as well, and would deliver gas onto the east, into the eastern coast at around $12 to $13 an MMBTU, which looks like the kind of price at which US LNG, depending on Henry Hub prices, would be delivered. So I think we're starting to get a benchmark price, which perhaps does make it more difficult or forces the higher cost LNG, potential LNG producers, to assess whether how competitive they will be in the Chinese market. So I think there's still a gap for the volumes, but I think there is we're converging on a sort of price expectation now, which is certainly lower than we've seen in the past couple of years, at least.
Okay. Ed?
Thank you, Charlie, and thank Jim and Jonathan for putting this book together, which will be a real contribution to the field. I think it's always good to bring reality-based analysis to Washington, because we often hear in Washington substitute perception for reality in policymaking. I don't know about Europe, but it's always good to have profits from overseas come to Washington, because sometimes a profit is not respected in his own country. I promise to do the same in Brussels and London as the opportunity arises. By the by, I mean, I think one comment on gas and the importance of gas to Russia that I might make is that it is definitely true that oil is all about money in Russia. But gas is often about politics, both domestic politics as well as foreign policy, and sometimes personal politics as well. And you can see that in Mr. Putin's very personal involvement in both Ukraine and the China deal that was just announced. Mr. Putin would rattle off Gazprom's statistics at a drop of a hat anytime anyone gives him the opportunity to. So this is clearly something very close to the Russian leadership. But the question I want to raise, which may be a subtext of the book, which I promise to read more carefully as time allows, is whether in order to meet the various market challenges that both of you have outlined, whether fundamental structural reform of the gas sector is necessary in Russia or not. The role that independents play, for example, it amuses me that Novatek and Rosneft are called independents. Be like calling ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips independents. In the American context, they hope to be independent from Gazprom, but otherwise they're not independents in the classical oil and gas patch sense of the word. Are they going to be limited, the so-called independents, to serving the domestic market, as they have clearly expanded their scope there? Are Yamal LNG and Sakhalin 1 LNG one-offs, or do they pretend to something that's larger in the future that will be a real liberalization of the gas market in Russia? One could easily explain Yamal LNG and Sakhalin 1 as Mr. Timchenko and Mr. Sechin's special relationships, rather than a systemic change that is over the horizon. So it'd be interesting for you to say more about that. If one were to become more responsive to the changing global gas market, which you mentioned, it seems to me that there's some changes would be necessary. Unbundling, which is kind of a four-letter word for Gazprom, certainly would allow better access to pipeline capacity by more producers than just a privileged few. You think about the associated gas that's flared all over Russia as a result of the structural rigidity of the current system. Given that supply is not the issue, is structural market reform necessary in order to achieve the kind of efficiencies that Russia may want to have? On Ukraine, it seems to me that not only is Ukraine currently relied upon for at least half of Gazprom's exports to Europe still, there's also a question of whether the availability of transit through Ukraine allows Gazprom to compete in the spot market in a way that these expensive new infrastructure projects, Nord Stream, Nord Stream expansion, South Stream, do not afford, because they are very expensive projects that need to be financed. They require the kind of long-term take-or-pay obligations on the part of the buyer in order for these projects to be financed. Doesn't the option of Ukraine, even into the medium to longer term, give Gazprom the kind of flexibility to price their gas to meet the spot market where it is, rather than be stuck with these long-term take-or-pay contracts? Really be interested to hear you talk a little bit more of your assessment of a recent deal in China. A lot of things are not known. Some of the Russian pronouncements have not been confirmed by the Chinese side, which I find interesting. There is almost certainly going to be some prepayment or loans required for the $55 billion that Gazprom estimates it will cost them in terms of capital spending on their side. We don't have a lot of details on the commercial terms. It is interesting in the slide that Jim showed, which was really a Gazprom forecast of the 2020 production from Eastern Siberia, it was very modest in 2020. So maybe this deal will cause them to revise their forecast. So how real is this deal, and when and how might we be able to tell? One other point that we would be interesting particularly for Europeans coming to Washington for us to hear more about is the EU's competition case against Gazprom, anti-competitive practices, allegedly. Which maybe a report should be filed not too long from now, maybe by fall. The other part of the picture that you can help us fill out maybe is how interested is Russia in the gas exporting countries forum? Is this just a talk shop that won't lead to anything, or is this something that in the longer run may have more legs than we seem to expect right now? I happened to be in Turkmenistan last week when Deputy Prime Minister Dvorkovich decided to make a refueling stop, I think, between Shanghai and St. Petersburg, and invited the Turkmen to the next meeting of the Gas Exporting Country Forum, which is in November, I believe, in Doha. So a little bit about that would be, I think, interesting for the audience as well.
Well, you raise a lot of questions, but before you gentlemen can address them, I'm going to ask Cliff to make a few remarks.
Right, that might make sense, since some of my questions would probably be the same as Ed Chow's, and I won't repeat them. I wanted, first of all, to say how happy I am to have a chance to not only read the book, but get a free copy, which I think a lot of people here in the audience are amazingly appreciative of. You don't typically do that in Washington, but I won't reveal that secret. Because this is an amazing book. It is really going to be, I think, the go-to reference book for anybody who works on Russia, who works on energy issues. It doesn't have to be narrowly focused on Gazprom or on Russian gas or gas at all. So I speak as a consumer. I mean, there's no way I can envision knowing at least a fraction of what's in that book, but I have the book and I can go to it. And I think it's going to be a wonderful asset for all of us. I wanted also to just make the point, Ed's made it to some extent, that despite the title of the book talking about markets and Jonathan's remarks about the complexities of supply and demand, competitive markets to which then Russia has to react. The book is more than just about the complexities of markets. It's also about the complexities, or as the terms keep coming back in the book, trying to balance different interests, trying to resolve the tensions between different interests. And this is not just between supply and demand. This is between largely the political imperatives, the political demands that are placed on the Russian gas sector and on Gazprom in particular, to resolve that in tension with the commercial demands. And in fact, of course, as the book points out, there's really three demands being placed on Gazprom. And it makes no sense whatsoever to look exclusively at Gazprom as a commercial entity and expect it to, so, oh, it's not living up to the profit expectations or the profit potential without taking into consideration that this is more than a profit-maximizing commercial entity. It is subject to that, which generates revenues for the budget. As the authors point out, actually a small percentage of Russia's formal tax revenues. I'll get to that in a second. But it also, of course, has the geopolitical role. And this book is exemplary in talking openly about the geopolitical role of Russian gas, but doing it in a very sensible, realistic, and balanced way, and pointing out, debunking the idea that gas is a weapon, and pointing out that this it's a lever, it's a point of pressure, it's used. In fact, if you use it, you probably will destroy your ability to use it in the future. So there's a lot of complexity there as well. And then finally, the role of Gazprom in Russia's domestic situation, which is both economic and political, and in Russia today, those are pretty much the same thing. It is to basically boils down to Gazprom's role in keeping an economy alive that's not always viable completely on its own. It preserves jobs in ancillary sectors, construction sectors, input producers, huge part of the former Russian defense industry, Soviet defense industry, is kept alive and was especially kept alive during the 1990s by orders from Gazprom for equipment, for everything from cables to pipes to everything else you can imagine, pumps, aircraft engine manufacturers being prime producers of pumps for Gazprom and so forth. It is a hugely important role, and it is expected to play that role, perhaps more than anything else. It may only produce, Gazprom may only account for 5%, or the gas sector, for 5% of Russia's tax revenues, but that's formal tax revenues. And if one were able to to compute the informal taxes, the informal burdens, social and economic and political, that Gazprom has to play. We'd find that it does, as I think Ed indicated, play a very, very important role. So there is that complexity, and that, in a way, the complexities, the trade-offs, and the tensions is the overall theme of the book. I really like it in that regard. And it's a twofold message, because on the one hand, the authors are identifying the huge nature of these complexities, the challenges, both in the market sense, the supply-demand equation, competitive market, but also in this other beyond non-commercial complexities that Gazprom faces, and bigger maybe than people ordinarily imagine, and they will only grow larger. At the same time, there is a positive message, which is what Jim ended the conversation on, about real signs that Gazprom and Russia more generally, or the manager of the big Russia Incorporated, I guess we should say, Vladimir Putin, is able to see and start to adapt. Maybe belatedly, who knows? What he says publicly has little to do with what he's really thinking. We know that by now. And I've heard him personally talk about just poo-pooing shale gas and playing down this and playing down that. And you tend in the beginning to take that seriously, but later you wonder, was that just a smokescreen? Was that just disinformatio, that we won't really know what he's thinking? But I think that my sense is, and especially after perusing this book, is that there is real capability for change in Russia. It won't necessarily be the kind of change that some people are imagining with the perfect market-oriented structural reform of Gazprom and so forth. But there will be change to adapt to this changing environment that Gazprom is in. And just to end on a very, again, on this very personal note of Putin's role, which Ed outlined or indicated pretty clearly, he does regard himself as the head of the whole energy sector, and especially of gas. But he's a man who hedges his bets, and we know that. He has fallback options. He avoids, under all circumstances, making a commitment that he can't somehow get out of. And with that sort of a mentality, given those challenges the kind that have been described in the book here, I think we don't know exactly what sort of changes he might undertake. And I think they could span almost anything with respect to the domestic organization of the industry as well as foreign markets. But we have to keep our eyes open because I think the gas sector, Russia's energy-based economy, is much more resilient than many people seem to realize or seem to indicate when they simply extrapolate forward from certain assumptions about past behavior. And to me, that's kind of the story of this book. I think indicating what the challenges are, what the trade-offs and tensions are, and then giving indications of how already certain changes and adaptations have begun to be made.
Thank you both, gentlemen. Don't know who wants to.
Okay. Well, why don't I try and pick up some of the more specific points? I'm going to leave Jim to talk about China and the independence because that's very much his thing. Can I just start by picking up a point that Cliff just made about the role of Gazprom? What we try and explain in the book is that Gazprom, if you look at energy business models, is caught between the business model of a traditional utility company in a producing country, where these companies are expected to provide energy for citizens at below cost. That is what they do almost everywhere in traditional producing countries. And one of the things that is interesting about the point that Ed made about reform is that actually the Russians have done pretty well in relation to their peers for reforming the gas sector in relation to pricing and also in relation to liberalisation. I don't want to make too big a deal of this, but if you take a look at some of the efforts in European, indeed EU countries, in relation to price reform and liberalisation, you will see that the Russians have quite a long way to go. But in comparison to where they were 10 years ago and where I, in my previous book, predicted they would be, they've done pretty well. Virtually every cubic meter of gas which is sold today in Russia is sold at a profit. Maybe not a big profit, but at a profit. Now, that's a big thing to say about producing countries. And in our book that we published in 2012 on gas pricing around the world, you know, what we saw outside the OECD
is just subsidy, 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 and unsustainable subsidy. And Putin himself did address that. So, you know, okay, there's not... certainly the third-party access regime is not perfect, but it exists, and Katia Fimva talks about it in the book. It's relatively complex. Unbundling is certainly not going to happen anytime soon, but it is talked about. That's quite a step forward that anyone would even talk about it. Let me just catch in a few Ukrainian, European things. As far as the availability of Ukraine transit and what that means going forward, I see this as a typical Russian chess game. In other words, they have their pieces on the board in different pipelines, and if necessary, they can move their pieces around the board depending on what the commercial situation looks like, depending on what the political situation looks like. They, I believe, would be very happy for some kind of resolution of the Ukrainian situation which would create a non-hostile relationship between the two countries. Whether they will succeed in that, given the Crimean Act, I wouldn't want to venture an opinion. But normalization of relations with the new regime in Kiev, I think, is a priority. Is it achievable given the kind of guy Putin is? Big question. The DG Comp case against Gazprom. Yes, we are closing in on what will need to be the statement of objections. For those of you, this is what you guys call antitrust. The key problem here is that the competition authorities are objecting to the continuation of oil link pricing in particularly the Central East European and Baltic countries. Gazprom is fiercely resisting this for all kinds of historical reasons. If they don't settle with the authorities, in other words, if the authorities do issue the statement of objections, if this was an EU company, there would be no discussion, there's no appeal. But, of course, this isn't an EU company, so Gazprom will appeal to the European Court of Justice. Those guys don't hurry. So we could well see this stretch on to the next few years, but in de facto terms, this will be settled within these contracts. In other words, I believe that by the time this is finally resolved, if it goes all the way to the European Court of Justice, or in contractual terms it would be settled, I would be surprised if the European Court of Justice decided to try and levy a big fine for historical violations, which the Russians anyway wouldn't pay. How interested in Russia in the GCF? Very, very interested in advertising, but not interested in reality. So Putin, when it was in Moscow, I think last year or maybe the year before, they made a big splash about it. Putin did a major sort of speech about it, which didn't represent anybody else's policy apart from his own. But the key thing really is only three countries are really high profile. And you know, the Qataris, the Russians... And the Iranians and the Algerians. But the problem is that the Iranians don't really export any gas, and none of the rest of them can agree on anything. So the Turkmens may or may not show up. They haven't shown up since the first meeting.
Sure.
And you know, this is something that journalists get very excited about, but not many other people.
Okay, so just to talk about the independence and sort of the... deregulation of the Russian market, and just to pick up the point that both of you made about balance, I think it's really interesting to think about why the independents, particularly Novatek and Rosneft, have seen such a dramatic increase in their market share and production. And I think it comes down to the problem that Gazprom has in terms of balancing its political objectives that it's been set by the Kremlin and its commercial objectives to kind of survive and operate as a commercial entity and at least try and make some profit to keep itself going and develop. And I think what we saw around post-crisis was, as the markets changed and Gazprom failed to adapt, was there was a risk, I think, that its commercial inadequacies were starting to lead to a situation where it could not fulfil its political objectives, or at least the Kremlin perceived that that there was a possibility that Gazprom would be losing its kind of dominant role and its ability to be a tool of foreign policy. And I think that pressure was being applied but from various angles, and again, balance is all about this. It's not just about this issue, it's about vested interests as well, because obviously Gennady Timchenko, who owns Novatek, is closely affiliated to Mr. Putin, and you know, Igor Sechin has his links as well. So, but I think that there was a sense that Gazprom commercially was failing, and that potentially it was in a downward cycle, and that elements of competition and also elements of encouraging Russia to start to develop its most competitive gas and get it into the marketplace was a driver. And I think you once saw that in the domestic market, because Gazprom's expensive new fields needed a higher domestic price to underpin their economics. We saw the regulated price at which Gazprom charges to its customers increasing by 15% per annum. And at some point, the independent producers found that actually they had Russia's cheaper gas and could undercut Gazprom. And from 2012 onwards, really, when Gazprom's five-year contract started to expire, they were allowed and even encouraged to compete with Gazprom to start to set what is a quasi-market price for gas in Russia now. It's not, you know, there is still a regulated price which acts as an indicator, but essentially now the independents and even Gazprom from 2014 potentially are going to be allowed to set prices above and below the regulated price. And this is because Gazprom's higher regulated price was undermining the economic growth of Russia, potentially in the post-crisis period, and consumers were complaining about high energy prices. And so one saw this kind of regulatory process develop, which would allow greater third-party access, allowed competition with Gazprom. But that doesn't mean we're heading towards a liberalised market. That means that there was an incentive to try and encourage some competition. And I think what we're seeing now is very much a kind of oligopoly. I mean, I think that there are now three big gas companies in Russia, Gazprom, Novatek and Rosneft, and we saw that development in the domestic market. And now we're starting to see it in the export market. And I think, you know, Gazprom's loss of market share until last year in Europe was one catalyst. I think Gazprom's inability to do a deal with China was another. And what we've seen is the LNG export monopoly broken in a very controlled manner. I mean, the legislation is very specific. If you're a state company with offshore gas, you can develop LNG. If you're a company with LNG in your license, defined in your license, then you can develop an LNG project, and that's Novatek Yamal LNG. So those are two very specific projects, so it is very limited. But nevertheless, it was a catalyst for action, if you like. It was a poke at Gazprom to say, look, get your act together. And it's you know, it's interesting that Novatek signed a deal and sold equity to CNPC before Gazprom signed its deal with CNPC. Rosneft has signed a joint venture with CNPC to develop East Siberian oil and gas reserves before Gazprom did its deal. So I think what we're seeing is a balance between the kind of commercial, the political, and the vested interests, and it will be a very controlled process. And, you know, looking forward, the next step could be third-party access to the export pipelines in the east. Rosneft has made a request that it be allowed to put its gas through the Power of Siberia pipeline, which could go to China or could be sold into the domestic market. And that is the next potential step towards a controlled liberalisation of exports. Now, there's no mention yet of the pipelines facing west being liberalised in this fashion, but you can see a step-by-step process by which the three companies try to find a balance in the east and then try to find a balance in the west, potentially. And anyway, so I think the liberalisation process is a slow one. I think that, you know, it will be, you know, many years before we see Gazprom broken up, but we're taking steps along that very slow journey. In terms of you know, the reality of the China deal, I mean, I see what you see, and I know it's difficult to be concrete about it. All I'd say is that from a commercial perspective, we've believed for about the last 3 or 4 years that the price at which they appear to have done the deal i.e. somewhere between $350 and $400 a 1,000 cubic metres, somewhere between $10 and $11 an MMBTU, is about the right price for both parties to make some money. We estimate that Gazprom can make a reasonable rate of return on its investment, assuming it invests relatively efficiently in the entire Eastern program. And, you know, we estimate that the gas can be competitive in China relative to alternative sources of supply. So, again, it appears to be a balanced commercial contract with, no doubt, lots of bells and whistles and nuances, but it would seem to make sense for us, for both parties, to take the deal forward. So whether it will or it won't, maybe there'll be some political shenanigans, but commercially it looks sensible. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if it did proceed on roughly the terms that we know.
Thank you very much. I think it's time to open to the floor. We ask that you please identify yourself and please keep your question a question and not a lengthy statement. And we'll let you can address it to a member of the panel, but if anybody else wants to weigh in, we'll proceed that way. Over here against the wall.
Thank you. Nico Tsafos, independent consultant. I wanted to go back to this idea of the prospective bubble and throw out a few possible reconciliations for that bubble, and I wanted to get your reaction. One is you reform the price at which you sell gas to Europe and you make your gas more competitive. The second option is you try to build a western route to China, which actually would bring gas from West Siberia rather than East Siberia. You try to just lower the price within Russia and just shove more gas into the Russian economy, or you just leave it in the ground for a better day. If you were to think about those four possible options, how would you think about the relative attraction of each one of them? Thank you.
Let's start.
Okay. Well, I mean, the realpolitik is leaving it in the ground is what is happening now. I mean, even if you don't believe Alexei Miller saying that they could have produced 617 last year when they produced 487, even if you think he was exaggerating by a factor, they have a lot of shut-in gas. Jim will talk a little bit about the independence on this. What I think is most interesting is, we as an institute have actually conducted a public debate with Gazprom on pricing. And what is fascinating is that they are still saying the same things about pricing and the importance of oil in pricing, but they have, after a lot of hard talking with their customers, they have adapted where they needed to adapt, which is in the competitive markets. So their prices are now competitive with hub prices, spot prices in Europe. Although the way they've done it is, incredibly kind of bizarre way of doing it. You have to pay, then you get paid back if you've paid too much. I mean, it's a crazy way of doing it. But they've done it. Now, question really going forward is, do they want to push more gas into Europe? And here we come back to what we described in the 2012 book as the discriminating monopoly thesis. And you see all gas exporters doing this. Qatar does it. They all do it, which is, how do I continue to compete in my main markets without crashing the price? And this is every so often they make a mistake and they crash the price. Or they starve the market and the price goes up dramatically. But what is very, very interesting, I think, now is that with this quote-unquote threat hanging over Europe, prices are falling. Prices in Europe are falling and have fallen around 25% since the beginning of the year. And what that says, what that is telling everyone, which they should have known already, is gas is in big trouble in Europe. Demand is falling, and it's falling faster than domestic production. So you want to sell your gas in Europe, you've got to compete. Gazprom finally figured this out in 2013. It lowered its prices. It massively increased its sales. It's not a complicated concept, but the practice is complicated.
Yeah, no, I just reiterate that. I mean, I think the interesting thing about Gazprom's gas is it is competitive. It's not priced at a premium anymore. And if you literally do the maths, in 2013, at some point, it's actually been cheaper than hub-priced gas, which is why volumes rebounded from 139 BCM to 162 BCM last year. And I think the Russians are quietly confident that Europe will not find alternatives and they have openly stated that if US LNG arrives in Europe, they will compete with it, and there is no doubt they could undercut US LNG in Europe. So if they want to, they can undercut the competition. There's absolutely no point in them crashing the price now. You're always better maximising price over volume, and that's what they've done. And in terms of your question about what do you do with the oversupply, well, there's a price in the domestic market below where, you know, they were losing money in the domestic market until 2009 when they just broke even for the first time. The price in the domestic market now is, give or take, the break-even price for Yamal gas delivered to Moscow. So we've reached a level now which Gazprom can make money certainly on its average cost portfolio and can break even on its most expensive fields. They could pump more gas into the market, but, you know, there's no need. The customers and producers seem to have found a level at which everyone is happy. The price isn't going up this year, and going forward, we'll see. But we look like we've reached equilibrium. In terms of sending gas via a Western pipe to China, absolutely, they'd love to do that. But the Chinese aren't falling for that. I mean, you know, that they can see exactly what Gazprom's strategy is, which is to sort of play off the European and Chinese market. China has plenty of gas coming into its Western borders from Central Asia, from fields where they have equity and significant political and commercial control. I think, you know, Gazprom's best hope is to sell more gas, or Russia's best hope is to sell more gas in the east using the new pipeline infrastructure and the existing pipeline infrastructure from Sakhalin. And the western route is something, you know, which Miller has claimed they're now talking about, which in realistic terms is somewhere out late 2020s, 2030s, I think, before we see any gas coming from West Siberia and
the Western route is one area where, you know, the lack of Chinese comment is conspicuous.
Yeah.
Even though the Russians keep talking about that's the route to get it up to 68 BCM. Drawing gas from a pool that is Western Siberia is precisely what the Chinese don't want. I mean, I think it's very significant that besides the determination of the Eastern route, which was a breakthrough last March, I guess, March a year ago, is the destination of Chayanda and Kavika as the source of that gas, which raises a suspicion in my mind as a recovering oil and gas man that maybe CNPC is going to try to claw upstream eventually. I mean, part of the attraction of designating the field from which the Chinese the supply to China would come from is that if and when Gazprom develops those fields with their usual efficiency, that there may be an opening down the road for Chinese to at least bring up the question of equity in those two giant fields.
We've got two questions over here, Tim and then Ariel.
Thank you. Thanks. My name is Tim Borsman with Brookings, with ESI. I would like to ask a question. You've hinted at the answer in the previous response you gave, but I'd like to learn more about Europe's desire to diversify its supplies. And I mean, it's not new, but it's been revitalized, I guess, in light of the Ukraine events. If I listen to you correctly, and knowing what with the background knowledge we have on competitiveness of fuel sources in Europe, seems to me that, you know, there's going to be increasing share of coal, I guess, in Europe, and then there'll be very competitive Russian gas. First of all, do you think that's a correct assessment? If it is, what does it tell us about Europe's desire to diversify its gas supplies, and, you know, how successful or not have its attempts to realize that been, in your view? Thanks.
Okay, well, I mentioned when I introduced our institute that we are some of the few people still working on the deeply unfashionable subjects of oil and gas. This is because 99% of people in European universities working on energy are working on renewables, climate, and other sustainable issues. And let me tell you that this is a horrible generalization, but I think it's a reasonable one. For most of the old member states in Northwest Europe, and for everyone under 35, this is the only subject that matters in energy.
You know, you go and give lectures to people on this subject in Europe, and this is like conversation. What do we care about this for? No, the planet's at risk. What, you know, why are we bothering with this kind of old-style hydrocarbon stuff? So this is the problem with promotion of coal. You know, still the environmental community have not understood that this is what's happening. The Tusk suggestion of an energy union is basically a manifesto partly for coal and to treat coal as, as an energy security product. Europe is nowhere with its climate policy and the EU trading scheme. This is something the new Commission will have to do as it picks up in the fall. I don't know how that's going to work out, but what I do know is that I am confidently expecting this coal to be massively resisted outside of Germany, where nobody can speak against it. Now, the question of alternatives to Russian gas, you know, this is a terribly politically incorrect thing to say, but there actually are no alternatives to Russian gas in Europe. You know, you can go through them. You know, conventional gas production is falling. We don't need to speak about unconventional gas. Just to tell you, if you don't know, that probably in the whole of Europe, no more than 100 wells have been drilled anywhere, and mostly where they've been drilled, they've either been unsuccessful or there's been massive resistance. In my own country, now you drill a well. This is before you fracked it. You just drill a well. And it is headline news on the evening news, and there is a massive punch-up between environmental protesters and police. This is for one well, okay? Then the big gas crisis in Europe that no one can even talk about because it's so serious is in North Africa. I know Egypt, I don't think we need to speak about. Libya, we have no idea whether any gas will be arriving in Italy from one day to the next. And the Algerians, you know, they haven't even issued any data since 2012 because we know what it will say. But nobody can talk about it. It's a very European phenomenon. You know, once things get too serious, nobody can talk about them. You know, East Med is a big resource, but it's probably going to stay in the region. Anyway, the politics are very complicated. And so on. So this is something that, you know, many studies have been done, many consultants have got rich doing these studies, but actually there's nothing much new to say that we haven't known for quite a long time.
I was just going to add a point. I mean, I think that there's a very simple analogy with the European situation. If Europe wants to diversify away from Russian gas and to have increased security of supply, then it just has to look at the Japanese example and say, fine, you know, you can do that, but there's a price. And I think that's pretty much what the Russians are saying. You know, look, if you want to do that, go ahead. But, you know, if you want gas at 10, come back and see us. And I think that that's why the Russians are keeping very quiet about the whole thing and just letting it play out. And I think the interesting dilemma for the European Union is played out in the whole decision about South Stream, where the Russians are offering to bypass the Ukraine to rid Europe of one source of lack of security supply and are being blocked from doing that for short-term political reasons. Now, so we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, of course, that doesn't diversify Europe in any sense from Russian gas, of course, but it reduces one of the transit risks. So I think, yeah, just to endorse Jonathan's points, basically.
Ariel?
Good morning. Excellent presentations, Ariel Cohen. Costs of production. If you look at Echayanda, you look at Eastern Siberia, Echayanda or even Kavikta, which is closer to the border, or if you look in the Arctic, costs of productions are very high. And this is land gas as opposed to offshore. But if you look at offshore Mozambique, that is shallow, if you look at offshore Guinea, that they're signing new licenses as we speak. Don't you think that this will go to Europe as well as eventually Eastern Med, and that the picture in the early 2020s is going to be quite different than what we see today, where, of course, Russian gas from West Siberia, which is legacy basin, has an advantage? And the second question is about Ukraine. Do you think Ukraine has viable options in terms of interconnectors from Europe, gas coming as LNG or otherwise, or even LNG into the Black Sea, with the floating LNG terminals, such as Odessa? Thank you.
Well, in terms of the upstream cost, the overall costs are high. I mean, the overall capital expenditure is high, but on a per MMBTU basis, I don't think they are expensive. I think they're, Russia's pretty competitive. I mean, I think, as I've said, I think Yamal gas delivered to Europe can be delivered at $758 an MMBTU. So I think it can compete with any of the offshore sources. Yes, absolutely, Arctic gas would be very expensive, but I think Arctic gas is not in our lifetime. So, you know, Yamal has
You're
more...
a young man.
Huh?
You're a young man.
Genuinely, I don't think I'm going to see Arctic gas coming out of Russia. Offshore Arctic gas. I think there's plenty of gas on the Yamal Peninsula to satisfy, you know, west-facing demand. I think, you know, clearly, Chandra and Victor will have their issues. The geology is more difficult. There's a helium issue. But it's all about transportation costs, really. It's just a huge distance to market from both. But I think that, you know, Russian gas upstream can definitely be competitive. And I think the interesting thing in the East is that we're also going to see, if Gazprom fails to deliver, we're going to see the same thing happen in the East as we've seen happen in the West, which is, and it's already been mentioned by Rosneft and by the energy minister, Novak, the independents have got gas. They'll just put in the pipeline. I mean, Novak's talking about 25 billion cubic metres a year of non-Gazprom gas going into the Power of Siberia pipeline. Rosneft's claiming it can produce 15 billion cubic metres a year of associated gas and gas from existing fields in East Siberia by the time the Power of Siberia comes on stream. So I think, you know, again, if we're disappointed, as we could well be, in Gazprom's efficient or inefficient development, there are other people who can step up to the plate. And I think that, you know, Rosneft's already been hinting at that. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Let me just say a word about Ukraine. I mean, there are complicated reverse flow options for Ukraine, which really you need to do a different presentation to outline. But I mean, what the Russians, I think, will be very clear about, because they saw this happen in 2012, beginning of 2013, is this is all Russian gas coming around the corner and flowing back in. So they'll be careful to try and price in a way in which that doesn't happen. The kind of tragedy in Ukraine is, yes, of course, you could do floating LNG or other LNG, but it would cost a lot of money. But the real tragedy is, you know, this is a great country which has been run by people who have basically abused their positions in the post-Soviet period. If this country could be run by people who would even give the place a chance, it can produce gas. It has domestic gas resources, conventional, unconventional, onshore, offshore. But the moment that things seem to be going well, somebody in government decides they, you know, like to take a position in a PSA that they've given to a private company. You know, if we could get just some semblance of workable government, you know, in that country, that would be fantastic, because there is this should be a rich country. It's just got everything it needs to be a success.
Thank you for a remarkable presentation.
Use the mic, please.
Oh, sorry. Thank you for a remarkable presentation. It's quite breathtaking. And the book is thick. It's quite astounding what you're describing, which looks like the potential capacity of Russia's well-situated geostrategic position and its implications in terms of oil and gas. So my question is this, and I'm confused, really. In the index, there are two mentions of climate change and Copenhagen, and not at least in a two-second flip-through, a significant amount of discussion about environmental implications, greenhouse gas implications, local environmental impacts, et cetera, which, as we know, is swamping the West in terms of offshore issues, in terms of all of the above. And I'm just wondering where and how and if that fits in, both as a cost dimension and also as a geostrategic dimension, given the seeming acceleration of opposition to carbon fuels. And I guess I would be particularly interested, although this may be off topic, of the Rosneft-Exxon center that is being constructed in St. Petersburg to take on environment, corporate responsibility type issues. Thank you.
Okay. Well, let me try and address the reason why we haven't done very much on that in the book is that there is quite a big literature on that elsewhere. And this book really focuses on what our comparative advantage is, which is not in that area. However, what is very interesting to me is, I mean, as a regular visitor to Moscow and a regular person who discusses gas and energy with Russians, is how little the climate issue, features on their agenda. They feel they can use it to their advantage because of gas's advantage, particularly over coal, but that's about it. Now, local environmental issues are much higher on the agenda, and there is at least some evidence of greater sensitivity to environmental issues when they develop new projects. And if you take a look at the Yamal development, and you look at the photo album on the Gazprom site, you'll see a lot of references to what they have done in order to try and counter the environmental problems that could have arisen. One of the things, though, that is very notable in Europe is that while the gas industry has really tried to play the climate card in its favour, it has almost totally failed. Despite the fact that it's a very logical argument, it's almost totally failed. It, you know, gas in most parts of Europe, or maybe in every part of Europe, is not regarded as a significantly beneficial fuel, despite the fact that in reality it is. It's not regarded as that. Environmentalists tend to focus on, you know, methane emission issues, which are unquantifiable and difficult to know. It's one of the reasons, but not the only one, that they are so fundamentally opposed to anything to do with unconventional gas. So that's kind of a start of a story that I would say. You want to say anything else?
I think Gazprom, in common with the rest of the European gas industry, risks underestimating the impact of renewables in Europe. Gazprom has, from what I've seen, has made one presentation outlining the traditional view of gas as a supplementary fuel to substitute for intermittency of renewables, obviously, and has made some effort to demonstrate, obviously, the benefits of gas over coal, but has failed to make an impact. I mean, I think Gazprom certainly feels that anything it says is taken as a bad thing in Europe. So, you know, they're obviously just talking their own book, and it's a Russian book as well, so, you know, forget it. They feel they're better off not talking. I mean, in the East, of course, it's very, very obvious that gas is replacing coal in the Chinese economy. So in there, the story just plays out as a very natural environmental story, and I don't think there's any need for, Gazprom feel no need to demonstrate that. It's just quite clear what's going on, that gas is substituting for coal, and they're part of that story.
Kevin?
Thank you, Kevin Massey with Statoil. Thanks for a great presentation. As we're in Washington, I want to ask a political question related to the U.S. Role in what's happening in Ukraine. I think the reasons that Jonathan outlined, we're unlikely to see the Europeans quickly adopt any punitive measures against Gazprom, but there's been a lot of talk here. There's been some draft legislation introduced in Congress that directly targets Gazprom. I'd be interested in your perspectives on what the effect would be of U.S. sanctions against Gazprom, or not specifically aimed at Gazprom, but one issue being discussed here is technology export restrictions. Would that have any impact on what they're doing in Yamal? What do you see as being the material effects of any U.S. unilateral U.S. sanctions against Gazprom?
Well, I'll start. I'm going to leave the Yamal question to Jim. But let me start. What I've been very careful to try and say in Europe is we have a political crisis with the Russians. Let's not make that into an energy crisis. And whilst I'm completely supportive of the general view of the Crimean annexation, I think we need to be really clear in Europe that we have an enormous amount to lose
from this relationship. And if we're going to impose significant costs on ourselves, let's be clear why we're doing it. I'm not saying there wouldn't be reasons for doing it, and should there be, which of course we all hope there isn't, any Russian incursion into eastern Ukraine, this would come onto the agenda very quickly. But if the status quo currently is maintained, my guess is there won't be any increase in sanctions and they will not go into the energy sector. One thing, though, that we should keep in mind before I pass over to Jim is, of course, this is not a new situation. US sanctions on Soviet energy have strong historical antecedents. And I think maybe before the US does anything, it should look back on what happened during those episodes to see, you know, how successful they were in achieving their aims.
I think the technology sanctions, and there are three big areas, I think. In the gas area, it's LNG. And I think you've mentioned Yamal. I was with the finance director of Novatek last week, and I think there are two things that are of concern to that project. One is the fact that they're buying the liquefaction technology from Air Products, which is a US company, and so if there was a specific targeting of that project, then that could hurt. And the other thing that's already having an impact is the financial sanctions and the threat of further sanctions, which are making banks nervous about lending. And the completion of the project finance for Yamal LNG has taken longer than expected for precisely that reason. But, of course, what we're seeing in both instances... Sorry, just to complete the technology thing. The other two areas are oil-related. There's obviously the Arctic offshore... offshore generally, but particularly the Arctic, with Exxon drilling its well in August this year in the South Kara Sea. Then there's the unconventional, where again we've got the pilot projects from a number of companies now: Total, Shell, Exxon, Statoil, now BP, and obviously that transfer of technology could hit. Now, but the response on a number of issues is, as we've seen in the gas sector, is to turn east. And particularly on the financing front, you know, where Novatek looking to finance a lot of the stuff now for Yamal, with, you know, Chinese banks, Japanese banks, Korean banks. So, you know, that's the response. On the technology front, it's not quite as easy, certainly in terms of the LNG technology. I think that would have an impact. In terms of drilling and the unconventional side, you know, you can get rigs from already 40% of Russia's rigs are coming from China. So, you know, they're on that front, there is a sort of a resource to turn to. I think the offshore thing is the difficult one. I can't see how they could drill in the Arctic without the support of the IOCs and the technology they bring. And I think that could have a significant impact. And I think that well in August is a massive PR event as well as a massive oil industry event. So that will be an interesting one to follow. So I think on those three issues is really where the technology can hurt.
Well, I think, unfortunately, we're going to have to cut it off there. I want to thank Jonathan and Jim very much, and Ed and Cliff for joining us. And please join me in thanking our guests.